Hey team, welcome to another episode of the Intentional Agribusiness Leader Podcast, the podcast where we actually explore the minds of leaders from all around the agriculture and agribusiness space about what it takes to lead intentionally in this industry today. My friends, if there's some value in here for you today, we ask you to subscribe to the podcast, share this with someone who needs to hear the message of what it takes to be intentional. Let's get into the show. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Intentional Agribusiness Leader Podcast. This is your host, Mark Jewell, and I am on today with Wally Beecroft from Exacto, and I'm excited to learn more about him. And I had to go look up the company because I was thinking about a different company when I saw that come across my LinkedIn. But welcome to the show, Wally. It's good to have you on here.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me. And yes, sometimes people confuse us with Exacto Knives, but we're a behind the scenes company, so you may not have heard of us.
Yeah,
upstream in business. So
cool. Well, appreciate you being here, Wally. Opening question for you, same as everybody. What does it mean for you to be intentional?
Well, for me, I just think of two different words, deliberate and purposeful. And so when I think about intentionality, you know, I think it starts at an individual level, like yourself. You know, how are you intentionally growing as a person, physically, relationally, spiritually, intellectually, all those areas of your own life? And then kind of growing out from there, if you're married or you have a significant other or close friends, it's that next circle. So for me, it's my wife, Stacy, and I have been married 33 years. We've got three adult kids and then their significant others. So how am I being deliberate and purposeful with them? And then you move out to business in your occupational world, right? And you get into what's the mission? What's the vision? Are we deliberately and purposefully going after it? And then beyond that, you get into the community or involvement in civic organizations and things like that that are really important to be involved with too. So I think of it in those concentric circle kind of ways.
Perfect. I love how you roll it out from, you know, self to the family, to the business, and looking at that. In our world, we call this the order of the kingdom. And where are the priorities? Where do they lie? Yes, of course, deliberate and purposeful. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Right. But then also applying it to those different boxes. And I would love more people intentionally thinking about, how do I be intentional in each one of those? So great answer.
And said that the hardest person to lead is yourself. And that's really true. And so if you don't do that over the long haul, I don't think you can sustain an impactful career in leadership or management and leading something forward. So.
Right. Absolutely. Good stuff. Well, give us a background on Exacto Inc., who you guys are, what you do, and help us understand.
Yeah. So Exacto has been around over 40 years, and I've been the CEO for the past five. It's basically an upstream ag input company focused on formulation and enabling chemistries. So in short, our innovation optimizes crop and plant performance. A lot of what we make are adjuvants or additives to products that help them boost their performance. They do better. They don't drift as much. They stick to the weed. They enhance plant performance. So that's what we do. We serve growers and applicators throughout all of North America, some internationally as well, in Europe, Asia, Australia. We have a wide network of distribution partners that do that with us and for us. Prior to being CEO at Exacto, I actually was involved as a board member with Exacto's parent company. And then I came on the holding company and ran all the assets of Cox Family Holdings prior to taking this particular role and leading Exacto forward. And there I was a president and COO, basically functioning as a managing director. So been around with this organization for about a decade now.
Wow. Very cool. And if I remember right from our initial conversation, you had a different background outside the industry beforehand. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So my career, you know, a lot of my career has been in the food, ag, or horticultural spaces. So prior to all of this, I was with a company called the Brickman Group, which was a national largest, you know, commercial horticultural services firm in the world. Actually ended up selling for $1.6 billion to KKR back in the day. And I got involved in that when it was first starting to grow, and they got their first round of PE and a couple of waves of that. Really exciting. I ran major markets for them and enjoyed contributing, but mostly learning as well along the way. Some great people there. Prior to that, I actually took a tour of duty in the nonprofit world for a long period of time with a large mega church. It wasn't a mega church when I was part of it. It was growing. I loved growing organizations and, leading, and I led all of operations there and cross-functional projects and all kinds of things for a period of time early, really early in my career. But most of it's been food, ag, and hort.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating trajectory to learn about your career, and I'm sure there's and we'd love for you to elaborate on this a little bit. If you think about the early stage working in nonprofit, how has that actually influenced how you show up in the private side?
Oh my gosh. So the story started when I was 16 and got involved in leadership there as a student. I was asked to lead a student organization and a portion of it. And it was like 40 students with six high schools, and that grew to 120. And then, I ended up having responsibility for like 350 students as a teenager, like late teenager in early 20, and volunteering. And I ended up interning there, but it was a great run. But I got to learn from guys like Ken Blanchard, like directly. I mean, we were John Maxwell directly. It wasn't like through people. I mean, they came to us and taught and trained, and I just had incredible mentors there. That organization grew to be, massive. I mean, you'd have 40,000 people coming through the doors a week. It was not a small operation. So I learned, really cut my teeth there in my very early years of my career. But the values that were transmitted, the skills, the wisdom. Just an incredible experience.
Yeah, I think about 40,000 people a week going through the doors of any organization, right? I mean, it sounds like a football stadium year round.
Yeah, I had the privilege of leading like events in the early days, in my early 20s, of thousands of people. Like I'm executive producing events of thousands of people. So I had this ability to organize. One of my bosses early on, he was a mentor of mine, Russ Robinson. He talked about He called me an organizing genius, and I'm like, I don't know what you mean by that, but I just do what I do. And he helped me find a picture of myself. And again, a lot of what you'll hear today is I've been blessed with incredible mentors and incredible people contributing into my life. And on passes for me to do that with others as a leader. And I've been trying to do that and pay that back for a long time. So.
Well, this is really, really cool to think about, how those early career things often play into other things that come down the road. And if I could give early career folks a little bit of advice, it's just be where you are and take in all that experience, because it's often we get impatient. It's not happening fast enough, and I feel like I'm failing too much. What other people think about me, and there's other reasons we move on or start to question our validity. Man, when I think about, I was just talking with somebody about this yesterday. I said, man, if I was 25 again, I would just be more aggressive, right? I would iterate more. I would fail more. I would take more chances, right? Instead of being so cautious, and continue to move. And now that's a little bit inherent to my personality. I'm a little bit more risk averse that way. But it actually, I mean, at the end of the day, the net result would at least be the same, if not better, right? Because you look just 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, 15, now, 25 or 30 years down the road, and it just keeps stacking. You get to know more people, you have more experience, and it's cool to see how that evolves and stacks over time.
It is. And it's, I just say learn from everybody, but do find mentors and look to people who are a step or two ahead of you. I was just with guys last week doing some work, and Jay Vroom and Scott Rollins. These two guys, oh my gosh, you talk about learning and mo role models and things that you can pick up from people. I mean, I'm still going like, I got to learn how to do that. Those guys are at what they do. So, I'm always learning. I'm always trying to improve what I'm doing. So, and I think everybody at a young age needs to do the same.
Well, there's a question coming up here, man. Since you kind of brought it up there, let's just jump to it. As you think about mentors and people that you've admired over the course of your career, who's been somebody that's really impacted you that you've really admired?
Yeah, so from a young age, my father-in-law, who was my girlfriend's dad at the time, was hugely instrumental in my life. He was an executive with AT&T, I didn't think of him as anything like a big deal, but he invested in me and he probably kept me close for a reason because he knew I was, his daughter was in love with me and I was in love with her and we were going somewhere. But he's probably got the highest EQ and people skills of anybody I've ever met. He was like Dale Carnegie to me. Like if you think of the guy Dale Carnegie and you've studied his work, I mean, he's just like incredible people skills. And then his daughter, my wife, is probably the most purposeful and intentional person I know. She's got the highest EQ of anybody I know now. My father-in-law's passed. And I also would mention Scott and Dick Brickman. I talked about them earlier, but that organization was a 70-year-old G3 organization that grew to this national scale. And I just, the values that they led with, the way they approached business and processes and making decisions and really the culture of the business, incredible experience. And anybody who was a part of those Brickman years and days still talks about it. And you know it's making an impact on you when you still use the quotes and the axioms and you tell the stories as if it was just yesterday. And it's been a long time for many of us that we've been there. And there were people within that organization too, Bill Hankelman, Mark Yelly, other people that I worked for and with that were just, they took the time with me and they invested in me. And I was a young leader. I was brash. I was doing what I needed to do. I was, I just charge ahead and they helped me stay on track. So those are some people I'd mention.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, let's pivot a little bit and talk a little, just talk tactically and give some people that are listening some of your thoughts on talent development, talent attraction, retention. I'm sure you've seen a fair amount of different ways, and I think it's really interesting actually with the nonprofit background and then being more involved in maybe private equity firms, held firms, some public, some things that have been sold off in different ways. What have you seen? What guides your decision making as it pertains to attraction and retention of good people?
Well, I've been fortunate because every organization I've been a part of or led, I try to drive, retention to a high level and turnover to a low level. And I generally operate with sort of a framework of people, process, product, and profits. So it's kind of a circular thing. And as you work those elements of a business, it tends to expand and you grow and you get more girth and you get the deeper processes and you get better with how you work with people. But we've averaged around, well, less than 7% turnover exact over the past few years. And that's incredible in the midst of this great resignation era that we're in. And I would say it starts with hiring. You've got to have a rigorous hiring process. We do. We took a blend of top grading, which is a great process for hiring people, along with Korn Ferry's competency model, and we just blended it and we call it Exact Talent. And our HR team put that together, and we've had a great opportunity to get people to find the right fit with Exacto. And people tend to go through that long, rigorous process, and it's either form or it isn't. But we want them to really, us and them, to find the best fit before they join and do the hard work ahead of time. So I would mention that. I think performance management's another thing, is just make sure you have got a great system, whether you use 40X or use EOS or something like that, have a system. And what we do is we sort of flip it too, is we, I, my philosophy is, people's performance and their growth is their responsibility. And as a leader, I want them to feel that and understand that. So really good leader I knew always used to talk about people operating, having freedom within a framework in their role. So they've got the field or the field of play and they know the boundaries, but they've got a lot of flexibility in it and they've got to manage their own performance. So when they do one-to-ones with their supervisor, they initiate the agenda for that every time. They send the agenda at a time. They're the ones initiating what they need support on and what that conversation looks like. Same with performance reviews. We actually send a questionnaire out and have them answer it before you bring the supervisor's opinion of somebody. We want them to have their own thoughts around what are they most proud of? What do they need help with? What are their goals for the next year? Where do they hit sticking points to really reflect on their own performance and own their own performance? And then, yeah, so those are some things I'd mention around hiring and performance management in terms of retention. So I think that was mainly your question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I just wanted to tap back on in there that you mentioned is having some sort of a system to follow. And you mentioned a couple of different companies that you use to form your, Exacto, talent components, and having models. Generally, if we deploy models, if they're good, hopefully we can measure progress within them. We can see them showing up in the organization in some way, shape, or form. And in my experience and working with a lot of different ag organizations from the ground up in this industry, there's this is one of the reasons for the podcast, but there's not a lot of intentionality sometimes in how we go about that. If we bring up EOS, people might say, what is EOS? Okay. And for those of you listening, it's Entrepreneurial Operating System, and what it gives you, right, is really a set of templates to run your business with, or frameworks with which to run your business, a system to be able to manage people, lead people, make decisions. There's different filters. There's a lot of companies, ours included, that provide those kind of things for folks, for people that want to be more intentional. There are a lot of them out there. I encourage people to go look at them. But just choosing something that you can deploy in your organization and be intentional about sticking with it and getting it to work over time.
Yeah, like I said, whether it's 40X or EOS, I mean, if you know what your wildly important goals are in 40X, language, and then you track towards that, and you have activities and key levers that you're pulling to get to that, and then accountability, cadence of accountability on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis. Keep refreshing that and working it, and you will be very intentional if you adopt any of the programs. And I'm not advocating for one or another. They're all good, and they all sort of accomplish the same thing. It's more just doing the process.
Absolutely. Hey team, please forgive this quick intrusion into the podcast, but I have a really important announcement that I want everybody to get their earballs on. And that is that we have an upcoming Thriving Leader event coming up August 21st and 22nd. The Thriving Leader is our flagship program. We have run this thing over 135 times across the broad scope of agriculture. Thousands of people have gone through this, and our coaching programs and our public events each year are free. We only run two of these per year because of that. And your next chance to get access is coming up on August 21 and 22. The next one will not be until 2025. So we hope to see you. It's in Kansas City. Head on over to thriving-leader.com. That's thriving-leader.com. You get all the details and to book a meeting to see how you can get free access for you and some of your team coming up at the Thriving Leader in Kansas City, Missouri, August 21st and 22nd, 2024. We'll see you there.
Talk a little bit about cadence of accountability. We in our work, when we're teaching coaching, we talk about what's your cadence of coaching for those one-on-one conversations and those, coaching your team. I'm curious what that means for you and in your context.
Yeah, so for us, a series of one-to-ones with direct reports and supervisors, those are key, and having those scheduled, having a set agenda for that, and having it emanate from and originate from the person who's owning their responsibility, not the other way around. We have, weekly meetings within the organization focusing on our using EOS, the rocks, or the really wildly important, most important goals of that particular month or quarter. And we just refresh those on a quarterly basis. And we've got annual rocks, we've got quarterly rocks, we've got, these that we're focusing on that ultimately drive us towards our overall, desired end result for a particular, fiscal year. So I think having that alignment and getting everybody on the same page, and then getting your rewards and incentive systems to really tie to that. That's super important, and understanding what you're reinforcing in your organization. By way of your bonus metrics, by way of priorities that are set, all those things are really important. And oftentimes you get what you're rewarding. And so I'd say look really hard at that. We've shifted around over the years to where we found a really nice fuel mixture, if you will, of metrics and bonus metrics and how we incentivize people in our organization, ultimately to create, a customer experience that's going to be value added for the customer at the end of the day. And if we're not serving our customers, we're not doing anything right. But that has to ultimately support and undergird that customer experience.
I think incentive programs, benefits, et cetera, those things are incredibly interesting. I feel like a complete neophyte in that realm, trying to solve for that, writing my own things for my team as I go through some of this. There's some great resources out there for that as well. They're also very custom to each company and what your products are and services and how you can reward certain things. But this is one thing I'll share. As an example, often in our, say, sales conversations with business decision makers, if it's a sales-related person, generally the number one request is to solve the problem of my people aren't asking for the business. They're not closing sales enough in that case, at least in the ag industry. That's what I come up with a lot. And there's always something underlying. There's more to it than just asking for the business. Inherently, that person wants to do a good job and they want to bring that business into the company. But there's a challenge there. And so when we get under the hood and we start looking at incentive structures, often the incentive doesn't necessarily incent asking for the business. Because in many cases, I found there's no negative consequence to not perform. Mm-hmm. They've been not closing for many years. And it's just now become a problem, right? And I don't know if you've seen similar things, but often that's what we find. When we lack intention in creating those incentive and reward structures, and we haven't actually sat down and put it all up on a whiteboard and figured out what would better look like in this case, what do those incentive structures need to look like? The downstream consequence becomes, I have a lot of salespeople going through coaching that cannot explain to me how they get paid.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That means there's a problem, Mark.
Right? That should be a gut punch for anybody listening that's in sales leadership right now. If your person can't explain to you very vividly, not only how does their compensation structure work, but where is the revenue coming from, or where do they intend for it to come from? Mm-hmm. Most people actually can't answer that question. And that scares me about a lot of organizations in the industry.
Yeah. Well, I've always employed a consultative selling approach, right? You're there to create mm-hmm. value for whoever it is that's buying your product or service. And if you're yep. not doing that, if you're doing that, then you're going to be winning as they win. And you've got to flip it and think about how it is that the grower or the applicator is going to win if they use your product or service. If you are at a retail level or your distribution level, how does the retailer win? If you're at our level, how do we help distributors create value for everybody in their sphere and what they're trying to do? You have mm-hmm. to win, you win. So ultimately, you're going to create the best products and services and innovations that do a great job for them. And it's competitive for sure. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's part of the cultural thing that I know we're going to talk about. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, let's go there, because I know you've been a part of building some cultures and experience some cultures. Yeah. So yeah. Any pro tips you have to share with us, man? We're all ears.
Well, I think, you know, this culture thing sounds really squishy, but there's a lot of really good levers to drive culture. Again, I talked about people, process, product, profit framework, but you get to hiring and who you bring on. And if you're bringing on people who want to win and who want to serve customers, and ultimately winning is serving customers. And so I think that fit from the beginning is important, but leadership modeling is another one. And one of the biggest challenges I've seen is when you have stated values or written values in your organization and you put them on the wall or you put them in your handbook and you talk about them all the time, and then leadership doesn't model it and you've got a variance. And and I think that gap is what causes a lack of credibility. It creates a toxic workforce. And if you flip it, if there is modeling that aligns with that at every level, not just the top, but the middle, and especially the people who are frontline leaders, that's where value is created, at the front line. At the end of the day, the front line is what creates value. And if you got a disconnect in the middle or at the top in that variance that I'm talking about, big problems. So getting clear on that, clear vision of values and direction, employee engagement is really key in how you drive that. We're consistently above 80% the last several years. People really understand what they're trying to do. They've got clear direction, support, and all of that. Employee development, that's another one. And I think, you know, really supporting your employees and their own goals. Like, we've put people through PhD programs, master's programs. Mm-hmm. We've helped people achieve their professional goals and their aspirations along with the organizations. And then we've got these people leading in our organization that stay because they're growing and people are growing. They want to be part of that culture. Last I'll mention reward and recognition, because We actually do core value awards every year, and we highlight the people who really most demonstrate these specific values that we've got on our wall. And it's a great time. People really take it to heart. And we do a very thoughtful process of selection and recognition each year. Oh, and there's one more I will mention, open communication. And this is a principle I learned a long time ago. I watched this in organizations where you get there and people tell you what they want you to hear. And what I always say is, don't tell me what you think I want to hear. Tell me everything and then tell me the last 10%, because they're going to give you about 90%. And I want the last 10%, because that's when an organization really is effective, because you're getting the truth on the table. You're getting the ideas on the table that people are afraid to say, but they need to say.
Yeah.
And usually that happens to be the very thing that helps unlock the potential of the business or organization. So that last 10%.
Yeah, well, that is fantastic advice. And I'm going to say this, I would love to have, we don't have time to unpack all the gold that Wally just laid down for you guys. So rewind about 3 minutes, maybe four, safely, wherever you're at right now, and just re-listen to that short, brief masterclass on some of the things you should be considering as it pertains to building your culture. I will tap back on the very first one that he said, though, which is about leadership having to be in alignment with the stated values of the company. This is one of the biggest issues that we run across, where we see people talking the talk, not walking the walk.
I have a lot of conversations with people about, and you have to have fierce conversations sometimes and say, listen, that didn't align. I'm just going to say it clearly. That did not align. And I want you to call me on that too, by the way. That goes both ways. If I misaligned, I want to hear it. Tell it to me in private, but I want to hear it, right? So I think having that two-way street, two-way conversation about values alignment is really key. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. What's been one of those big hurdles you've had to jump over the course of your career, Wally?
You know, it's pretty recent, actually, with COVID, and in 2021 following it, we all in this industry experienced a huge supply crisis, and it was prompted by the great Texas freeze, for those who remember all the plants that went on force majeure, and rapid spikes in raw material costs and all of that. That was a really challenging era. I would say this, our team was amazing during that time. We gained a lot of business because we have this deep network of suppliers and wide, it's wide and deep. And that allowed us to do things that we wouldn't normally be able to do, or that we had to do in that situation to basically make sure our customers had products going into a growing season.
Yeah.
Brought about the agility, you know, the determination, the grit, and all of that. It was really, honestly, one of the most difficult times I've encountered in business over the years. So,
yeah, that's it's interesting to hear it from the supplier side a little bit differently. And certainly, we work with a lot of people that are representing the end product to the consumer, to the end consumer of the things that you guys are involved with making. And that's a lot of our coaching base. So we've heard it from their perspective and trying to just not have product to sell in some cases or whatever. But you had to think about, wow, like the logistics of getting the raw materials and the things that you all need to create the different adjuvants and things that you're making. Wow.
It was a lot of work, a lot of long hours, a lot of work in the lab formulating, replacement materials sometimes and substitutes and things that you had to do to get through that time. It was very challenging, but looking back on it, I think it was one of the best times for the company.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can relate. That was easily the most challenging couple of years of my career as well, being an event-focused company. And even when things opened back up, in some cases, especially being in heavy footprint in ag retail, and then ag manufacturing of different products that get sold through ag retail, which is where we play the most. A lot of people continued to go to work, they continued to do things, but people development was not a priority.
Right.
After that, right, there was solving the supply chain issues and figuring out other challenges, right? That that got the bulk of the mind share, and it was a very tough couple of years for us. And we got to do a lot of recalibration during that time. We'll say that.
So, yeah. Yeah, Maslow's. Yeah. That's sort of the fundamentals. Is I need product, right? So for sure.
Yep. Absolutely. What's been one of the biggest wins for you?
You know, I wouldn't say it's just one win, but the last couple of years with Exacto, we've just been on a tear in terms of growth, top, middle, bottom line, doing great. And building out a rack of leaders at every level has been so satisfying, just having depth, bench depth, and the ability to see people leading at every level. And I talk a lot about that in terms of it's one thing to have leadership in an organization or a leader or a couple leaders, but if you've got an organization that's stacked with talent that lead and influence in their areas of responsibility, you start to see great things happen. And so I would say that the last few years have been really satisfying and really fun. We've been really cautious too. I'll mention this about allocating capital very strategically into our innovation. And so over that last couple of years, while we've been performing well, we've actually been building this innovation engine and pipeline of products that are coming out over the next few years that have a lot of value for our customers, for growers, for applicators that are going to be really useful going forward. So I'm excited about, you know, not only what we've been doing, but what we're about to do over the next couple of years. So.
Wonderful. Very cool. Well, I know that you have as you think about influence and being an intentional leader, making sure that you're giving back to the industry that feeds you. I know you're involved in a few different things right now. So what's high on your plate of giving and getting involved and assisting in the industry right now?
Yeah, late last year, I decided to jump in and get involved more in the industry and help. There's a big thing going on, and if you aren't knowledgeable about the Farm Bill and what's going on with the EPA and this Endangered Species Act, I'd encourage you to go to cpda.com and look into that more. The nut of it is the EPA has been under a lot of pressure, a lot of legislation, or a lot of lawsuits against them to finally enact this Endangered Species Act, and ultimately. The challenge is going to be, so I joined the board of CPDA, Council of Producers of and Distributors of Agrotechnology, late last year, and I wanted to get involved because this is going to be very challenging for farmers if it's implemented the way that they're planning on it. And so we're advocating some very specific recommendations to go into the Farm Bill for 2024, as well as to the EPA regarding the mitigation tactics or strategies to eliminate what's this buffer zone that they want to put around the waterways. And again, everybody here always wants to protect our streams, our lakes, our rivers. Nobody's disagreeing with conservation principles and being sustainable. But what we do want to make sure is that the solutions that are being called for and that are included in that are ones that we can do. And, because the risk is that 10 to 20% of farmland in the US could go out of production. And that's just not going to work. It's not going to work for everybody, right? The way I put it is if you eat or you like to put clothes on your body, or you like to get somewhere like food, feed, and fuel and that kind of thing, this should be a priority for you to learn about and put your weight behind with your legislators in your state. Your congressmen, your senators, and get involved to support it because we've got some recommendations. And again, we are an adjuvant producer, so we have tools, right? Drift reduction adjuvants that could stop this overspray to get into those streams and rivers, which would reduce that buffer zone down a lot to really a very minimal amount, and I think allow farmers to take advantage of all their acres. And it is a big issue. It's an issue for growers, but like. You know, it's actually a national security issue. It's actually a food security issue. It's actually affects inflation. There's some really big impacts to this, and we want to help guide and support the Farm Bill as well as the EPA on this thing. So.
Well, it's a fascinating challenge and a very big one. And to me, it's almost reminiscent of what we're seeing in Europe right now with the farmer protests. And of course, our mainstream media doesn't pick this up in America, but I've seen plenty of it that you can find through YouTube and YouTube Shorts and TikToks and things like this, where people are getting the word out, and you see some pretty incredible protests, really, of farmers rallying together to fight, you know, for their rights to run their business the way they need to, so that they can produce food. And I feel like this battle has been lifelong for all of us in different ways, right? I can remember. A little backstory. So I didn't grow up in a traditional ag background, but we did grow up very rural. And until the mid to late 1980s, we actually ran a fur trading operation. So my dad raised fox,
We raised Fox like a cow calf herd in a way. We had Fox in pens, and he would, you know, breed the females in the winter, and then raise up those Fox, the Fox pups, you know, over the course of the spring and summer. And then they would, you know, we'd kill them and skin them and things like this. And that was the business. Now, not necessarily the most popular in this day and age to run that kind of business, obviously. Right. And it certainly was becoming less and less so. And there are two key things that happened in the '80s that killed the fur market. One was the Russians stopped buying fur from America. And second is the animal activism. And there was a particular media event in the late '80s where an animal activist threw red paint all over the fox fur coat of Yoko Ono. And this went viral for the day, right? And the price of fur plummeted very quickly. And we ended up losing, we almost lost the entire farm. We lost the entire business and everything. So firsthand experience growing up in a household that has lost their livelihood due to, in some parts, regulation, due to negative public perception and so forth. And so I, that's a very visceral experience in my cells that I, that I've lived through. And so I have a lot of empathy for those that whose livelihood is being threatened by regulation and other people's ideas and so on and so forth. And so definitely advocate for the work that, that you're doing. And, you know, we need to keep the right. It's not that we don't need to advance. It's not that we don't need to get better. But as you guys are proving out, the market will correct itself. If there's a need to do better, companies like yours will create innovative products that help us to do better. And I think the general, sometimes the, whatever the incentive is to work against the way we do things, I don't know where that's coming from, but whatever that is not patient enough. But if you just give, you know, the economics will always play out. If it's gonna, farmers are always want to innovate. They always want to get better. And sometimes it takes time, but you don't have to regulate all of that innovate. You can't regulate all this innovation into existence.
Well, I will tell you this. I think our the congressmen and senators and people we met with, they're listening. The EPA is listening. I think they'll come to common sense solutions and use these tools that we have. And I think that people need to understand that there really isn't that big of a difference between people who are very far on the, maybe they're a climate change or sustainability type person. They really believe that to the core of their being. And then you've got people who are conservationists and they love the land, that like the land is their livelihood. Those who are in farming, those who love to hunt, fish. We don't like stuff in our water. We want our water good. So really, I think there's a lot of overlap, and I think a lot of reasons to come together, no matter what, how you think about it, what is in common is that we care about the planet, right? We care about how it functions and how it's safe for not just us, but like future generations that are going to inherit it when we're not here. So,
Well, appreciate the work that you're doing there. Wally, let's bring it in for a landing with a little speed round on some of our final questions here. So what, if you could point people in the direction of a great book or podcast that has helped you out, what, where would you point them to?
Well, I'll tell you what, and mine's going to be probably a little different than most, might give you a self-help book or whatever, but I love history and it's really timely because we're coming up in 2 years on our country's 250th anniversary. So I would recommend, if you haven't read the late David McCullough, his work on like 1776 or John Adams or any one of his books, I would highly encourage you to dive in. They're a little bit harder to read, but if you understand our nation's history and our founding fathers, and those men were intentional, those women were intentional because they're influenced by a lot of women who were involved in that. It's a very important era in our country's history, obviously the founding, but if you want to learn a lot about leadership and intentionality, I'd go there. The other one that I'd recommend, and I love it, is called The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. And this is about Winston Churchill during World War II in England. And it's a fantastic book. Eric Larson, The Splendid and the Vile. Really good.
Okay. Two history books. I like the angle that you're taking.
That's me.
That's good. What do you do to keep your energy up?
So I'm a little different because I'm more of a sprinter than I am like a long distance runner. I tend to run in bursts. I get a lot of rest and replenishment. My wife says I'm like our old dog Ranger who would go play for like way too long and you'd have to like incentivize him to come in from the lake because he'd be running for all day long and then he'd drop. But I have to keep this regimen up of rest, replenishment, rejuvenation, like physical fitness, you know, staying in day activities with our family, hiking, golfing. We love to downhill ski, get out in nature. I like hunting. So anything that kind of fills me back up again is really important. And you've got to have a cadence there and a rhythm there. So just to fill the tank back up.
Yeah. Beautiful. I know you're a big systems guy. How does that play into your maximizing productivity?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is something I learned from an author named Steve McClatchy. He's also a speaker and author, but he had a book called Decide. And Steve would always talk about bucketing your activities into two camps. One is a gain activity, something that's going to move you forward. So these are important things, but not always urgent. And then the prevent pain activities, which are kind of maintenance activities. And basically what I learned from Steve was, and I've been doing this for a long time, a couple decades, because I learned about this from him a long time ago, but putting it in your calendar when you have your maximum energy, because all of us have rhythms to our own. Like some people are morning people, some people are evening, and wherever your most productive time where you can get into that flow state or best zone of work, put those activities in that bucket. And then all your prevent pain emails and certain meetings that you have, expense reports, put those in like the times when you don't have that maximum productivity energy zone of your week. So it's really kind of about how you structure your calendar and how you think about that. That's something I learned a long time ago and I've been implementing. It really is helpful for me, especially being a guy who runs on energy bursts versus being a plotter. I'm just not a plotter.
Got it. I like it. You know, there's different personality styles. My wife and you, I think, are very similar. She's a sprinter. She calls herself the fast start, right? So she goes fast, implements quickly, learns new things quickly, implements quickly, makes it happen. And then it needs deep states of rest, relaxation, pull away from it. Which interestingly enough has challenged me a lot actually, because I grew up in a household where we didn't vacation. We didn't go places. We didn't downhill ski. Most of that was a function, I think, of the economics of our, you know, family situation at the time. But she and I being in a bit different situation, we now, I mean, the last, to give you an idea, it's coming up here. The last week of each quarter, it is blocked hard. So that last week of each quarter, there's nothing going on regarding work. There's nothing going on regarding anything, right? Even like volleyball tournaments and the kids stuff. It's like, this is time for us to rest, recover. We might go to Colorado to go skiing. We might go to Mexico to a beach. We might just shut down in the house, you know, for a few days and save the money. But it's about rest, recover, and being strategic, working on our business, working on our lives, as opposed to that. And then that comes from her. Man, it's fast and hard, and we go. And I'm much more of a plotter, right? I just get up and go every day, and I'm cool if it's the same thing every day, with some variety. But I admire people like you that can just sprint and go and really get a lot done at once.
Yeah, both are very valuable. My wife is more of a plotter, and we complement each other and frustrate each other sometimes, but it works out really well because of the way we come together on it. So
yeah, very cool. Love it. All right, what's we'll try to get in this last couple of questions here. So what do you need to improve on this year? What's big on your list?
Yeah, you know, like I said, I'm just saying I'm learning from this process of being involved in advocacy. And that was a goal that I had early in the year, to make sure that I was engaged in that. And I think improving on that would be, you know, taking the message forward. Like I was in these meetings last week in DC with the guys I mentioned earlier, Jay Vroom and Scott Rollins and stuff. And, you know, getting that message across very succinctly and communicating in tight bullet points, you know, just having my message be very clear and concise, and being able to tell that story quickly and being able to influence, I think, in that same way. So that was one area where, you know, I got involved and I had this incredible learning just watching these guys do what they do, and then be able to, you know, do my small part in that process. So that's one area.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Last question that I really like, and I think I'm sure you have a good take on this, but how important is vulnerability to you and being able to run an intentional work environment?
It's everything, because when you think about a learning organization or an organization that wants to grow and get better, and people that want to grow and get better at what they do and improve performance, right? You have to be vulnerable. My daughter is a new neonatal intensive care nurse, and she comes home from work and she's living with us for a season to kind of get her feet under her, working the night shift, but home, and she's like, you know, I have to ask a lot of questions, and I have to say, I don't know something. It's like, yeah, you do, because you don't know everything. And she knows that, of course, and she's very wise. And I think it's really important that in an organization, especially, that you're able to say, listen, I need help, or I don't understand something, or can you rephrase that? Because I'm not completely clear on what you just said. That vulnerability of saying, I don't know something, is very hard for people. It's very hard for me at times, like, but that's the key to growth, because you're learning from somebody else and you're actually being vulnerable to say you don't understand something. So that's one thing. Other one I would say is, you know, make sure people can express their doubts and even challenge one another, and having a high trust, high challenge, high speed organization comes from being able to have those difficult conversations and creating a culture that says that's good. In fact, it's not good if you're not having them. And if you don't have enough tough conversations in your organization, I'd be wondering if everything's okay, because a good organization has a healthy amount of constructive debate, constructive dialogue. Again, always done respectfully, always done in the right way, but challenging and saying that last 10%. And that's a vulnerability thing. And then the third area would be personal, right? I mean, we're all whole human beings. We're not just workers and cogs in a machine. We come from families and we have issues. And anytime those conflict or are challenging at work, I think people being vulnerable and saying, look, appropriately vulnerable, I've got a personal challenge and this is impacting things and here's the support I need. Come forward with that and say something, because in an organization should invite that, because we all have issues that come up and we should be supportive, right, of one another.
Absolutely.
In those areas of our lives. So
cool, Matt, I'm so glad we made time to get through all the questions today. There's so much knowledge that you guys are getting from Wally in here, and just a wealth of experience, well thought out and well planned for, very intentional. So Wally, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for for sharing all this information. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure. Appreciated the time.
I hope today's episode brought you a great deal of value about what it takes to lead life and lead in this industry with intention. If you want to go deeper on the topic of leading with intention, I encourage you to head on over to intentionaltoolbox.com and get the 7 free tools that will help you to lead your life in all areas with a greater deal of intention. That's intentionaltoolbox.com. And finally, if this message resonated today, if there's something in here that you got value from, I promise you there's someone else in your life who also would get value from this. So please share the episode, share the podcast, and make sure that you subscribe.